You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest on the phone tonight is Robert Wintner, who also goes by the name of Snorkel Bob. He runs a snorkel rental service across the islands in Hawaii. He's an activist fighting the loss of tropical fish and the destruction of the coral reefs around the world. 2 years ago, we had a chance to talk with him about his book, Some Fishes I Have Known. Tonight, we'll talk with him first about his new novel, Flame Angels, a novel of Oceania. And then we'll turn to his other new book, a collection of his photographs. It's entitled Neptune Speaks. Welcome, Robert Wintner, Snorkel Bob.
Aloha, Steve, and it's good to be with you again.
Let's start with your novel, which we totally enjoyed, A Page Turner. It's the story of Ravid Rakholz. He's a scuba dive leader. He's an underwater photographer. He's an activist working to preserve the reefs. Now, we're not going to make the mistake of assuming that you and Ravid are the same character, but there are some obvious similarities. Could we start by telling us a little bit about Ravid Rakholz? How did you conceive the character? And if there are any similarities to your own life, perhaps you could tell us about that.
Sure. You know, anybody who's listened to this who likes to read good fiction knows that it comes primarily as two types, inventive fiction, and it's all fiction is inventive to a point, and then fiction drawn on real time, real world experience. And I'm pleased to say that I come from the latter school. Everything that I write is drawn from experience. Sometimes it's the experience of friends, but the majority of it is personal. I would say that it's an honest error to think that Ravid Rakholz is me. He's not. But some of the characteristics, you can't avoid some personal reflection in a character when you're writing fiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the years, I should say over the decades being here, I've had the good fortune to be pretty good friends with some really unique water people, water men and water women, and some of the stories that you hear, you know, the biggest dispensary of news in the tropics is the coconut wireless. Most of the really heavy stuff doesn't go on the news. And some of the stuff you hear is just so outrageous, it makes an impression. And you file it away for later, which is what I did. And that's how Ravid Rakholz evolved.
Ravid is Moroccan-born, raised in Israel, wends his way to Hawaii with questionable visas and so forth. How did that become part of Flame Angels?
One of those things, you really don't know where a story is going to go until you begin, you know, the narrative mix, see what works and what won't work. I do have a friend from Haifa, and he's back in Haifa. And I would have to say that, you know, of all the influences on this character, he was possibly one of the greatest. And, you know, of his tall tales, I always thought he was a great waterman, one of the people I wouldn't mind being up next to in a tough situation. But he had very bad judgment in business and in love and romance. And, and from there it just got to be whatever was fun. I tried it on for size.
And obviously, you have to draw on your own experience. You're someone who has a lot of experience with the coral reefs and with the ocean. In what of your important experiences did you draw on to create Flame Angels?
I think it's more than anything that second nature that comes with exposure. It's familiarity. It's kind of like the difference. Well, you can look at anybody you've known for years. Say, you two with each other, you can just look at the difference between now and the time you met. It's a thing that grows gradually. With the ocean, you know, respect is foremost, as it is with any relationship, but the ocean can throw tantrums and tempers that'll take you out if you don't respect it or you make wrong calls. And, you know, good water people, above all, respect the potential. And, you know, people over the years do get caught out in one situation or another. I could tell tall tales from personal experience all day long. But the key is, and I think it's part of the continuing romance, is that when you know that it doesn't look good, the line in Vegas is probably going to be against you. You default to calmness. It's a huge, valuable lesson in life, and it, 9 times out of 10, it will get your hind end out of the sling in the ocean. Mm-hmm. I've been in currents that I thought, my God, I was in one about 6 or 8 months ago. I'm too old for this. It was down in Palau. It was a 4-knot current. And the instruction for the group was to hook on to the bottom, which I don't like to do because it's just a nasty idea. If you did hook on and look sideways, it would rip your mask off.
Oh my God.
I was holding my camera, which is a pretty good-sized rig, and I thought, what am I going to do, put this between my legs? I don't think so. I'm not doing this. And so I let go, and I was out of there.
Wow.
A couple of sharks. In fact, this shows up in the next book we're going to talk about, Neptune Speaks. A couple of sharks hooked up with me, which they do. Big animals tend to entourage in the deep ocean. In about 3 seconds flat, we were out over the ledge in deep blue, still moving at 4 knots. These big guys weren't in the least bit aggressive. In fact, they were a comforting presence. I got some good side shots of them.
Wow.
I had to stay 15 feet for 3 minutes to, you know, slough nitrogen, and I came out with no land and no boat in sight.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, that oh, my God is easy. It's a luxury that you just can't afford. You come to the surface, and you're breathing air. You made it, and the current's going to take me. I was not in control. But, you know, I had faith that this dive outfit was at least competent enough to know that I might get caught in a current and then know where the current might take me. And I rode it for about a mile, and I saw a little speck, and sure enough, it was our boat. And I came up to it, and the guy at the helm was sleeping. And I came on board. He says, oh, you, hey, how you do?
That's not quite out of the novel, but Ravid has a number of experiences like that, including getting caught in the currents with while he's in charge of a dive group. And, yeah, he does remain calm. We have one segment we want to talk about a little bit later where he is a little less than calm, but maybe we can get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
The book is called Flame Angels. Can you tell us what flame angels are and how they became the title of the book?
Well, they... flame angels are angelfish. There are many angelfish. There's potter's angels, and there's all kinds of angels. And flame angels are, you find them across the Pacific, especially in Hawaii, and they're a dazzling fire engine red, and they have vertical bars on either side, about 5 bars in black.
Mm.
All angelfish are shy, painfully shy. To get a good photograph of a flame angel takes remarkable, or really any angel, takes remarkable patience. And Ravid, you know, is not so much a conservationist. He doesn't really fight for reef issues. He lives that second nature. He's a dive leader. He's on the reef every day. And he not only establishes the familiarity and the love, he makes specific friendships. And for him, one of the rarest, most demure fish out there are flame angels. In reality, flame angels have been decimated in Hawaii by the aquarium trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hold a special place for me. It's gotten to the point where I didn't see a flame angel for, 20, 25 years. Mm. And there were anecdotal horror stories of flame angel was spotted and word got out, and within, 2 hours, two guys came down with a net and bucket because they wanted that fish because they could sell it wholesale for $40.
Mm-hmm.
And this stuff is hateful.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate it, and my characters hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And now when you see one, you don't talk about it. If you tell a friend, it's in confidence, and it's a friend who you know you can trust not to spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, every good title wants to have a double entendre, and of course this one, and if you read the book, you know, the flame angels are also the characters. These are long odds people trying to make a living from a wild natural resource, not by extracting it, but by, you know, living in harmony with it. And that's really the gist of the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to read a segment to us? Perhaps a segment where Ravid is exploring underwater photography and meets up with a creature he had not anticipated. Go ahead.
I know the scene you're referring to. I'll set it up briefly.
Good. Thank you.
Usually people who get certified as scuba divers go through a sudden transformation from, you know, anticipation, apprehension, anxiety, and fear to, my God, that wasn't bad. I can do this. And it's unavoidable to get a little bit of macho foolishness in there and lose your better judgment. This is so easy. That fear they tried to put into me was just not based in reality. And people do stupid things. Mm-hmm. And you really have to, like I say, it goes back to respect. And this is also based on real time. The person this is drawn on will remain unnamed. But he was a fledgling, self-taught photographer, very capable diver, and really broke two cardinal rules of scuba diving. Went out by himself, number one, and number two, at night. And so that's the setup for the scene.
Okay.
Anybody who dives knows that, you know, you got all these, you got your inflator to worry about and your computer and your octopus, which is your secondary air. And if you have a camera, that's two hands required there. And then you have your light if it's nighttime. And so that's the setup for the scene. And I'll begin. This is on page 50.
Great.
I have the hard copy. He turned suddenly to a presence felt rather than seen, and on coming nose to nose with a giant moray eel, he gasped. The eel wasn't so much bigger than himself, unless they could have stood back to back on their tiptoes, stretching the eel's curves. The eel would have won by a foot and a half with similar girth. Worse was the moray's presumption. Opening wide in an obtrusive display of very long teeth in many rows, crowding the fleshy maw, the eel assessed the plausibility of swallowing the prey before him. Ravi cringed, as it were, to a more palatable size. As his heart and sphincter slammed shut in the face of death, Ravi turned away, one hand grasping his light and the other on his camera, with no hand for the knife strapped above his ankle. Well, what could he do with a knife anyway, stab a giant moray? He might discourage it, but it could bleed, encouraging others. Or an outright attack might stimulate response in kind, causing Ravi to bleed, discouraging him. Glancing into the ink-black water of his retreat, he opted against the knife. He could make the beach on instinct and compass bearing, but dropping his light would render it pitch dark with no alternative but a surface swim. He would gain nothing by dropping the camera except the chance for a one-handed knife fight with a giant moray, who would likely be the least of his problems, and the camera would come in handy as a sacrificial chomp for other gregarious feeders. So it was flight over fight, jamming the fear-frozen muscles into overdrive on adrenaline thrust. He sensed a proper course to survival, determining the critical need for and making a mental note to buy a spare light. But he slowed into knowing. The sea is innocent. Its predatory nature based on fundamental need, which is not psychotic, perverse, or similar to human motive. Small fry gobble plankton, box fish eat small fry, and so on up the menu. Nobody in the sea kills for sport, personal aggrandizement or compensation for lesser attributes, or for photo ops or mental derangement. Hunger and defense drive the system. This so-called giant met by chance hails from forebears and a social context far less egregious than my own. So the flight stopped, a long but short way from the point of origin. So the diver turned to see the giant moray also turning back from the verge, perhaps lured back by the light now shining his way, re-engaged, socially perhaps. Ravid pointed the light askew to avoid blinding the giant. He shone it on himself so the giant could see, among other things, no harm intended, and that he, the diver, would not qualify as prey, not without a severe risk of indigestion and heartburn on so much neoprene, nylon, plastic, and steel. So the giant moray snaked gracefully back to social proximity as the camera rose into place. It was the diver's innate skill kept him neutrally buoyant. With the light angled obliquely, the subject was lit with dramatic shadow, overtone, nuance, and clarity. Aiming the camera one-handed, Ravid held his breath. Noise and bubble ceased, and there in the black water off the point in the faint glow of a tiny nightlight, a tableau formed in which a tentative being assessed the nature and intention of another being of equal uncertainty on a chance meeting in a dark hallway. So the big galoot came on like a stranger from the country, with eye contact, cautious curiosity, and shared interest. In near intimacy, each creature scanned the other. One sniffed the strange new fish with a bulbous bug eye. The other made a soft clicking noise as the shutter opened again and again on the eyes, the mottled skin, the dilating nostrils, all four of them, and hundreds of teeth, some in need of flossing and all defying a neat tuck into the maw. The eel breathed, as eels do, opening and closing to push water over the gills and pursing a word, aloha. The giant moray eased to apparent bliss and beatitude in communion never before seen, much less photographed.
I really love that line. He slowed into knowing. And then the description that gives us that knowing. I think that's really a great way to set that up.
And that process is exactly what we talked about a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When the fear hit, you must default to calmness and a set plan for here's what you must do next, whether you're afraid or not. The fear must, it becomes incidental. And mm-hmm. so you just set it aside.
Right.
There is that other scene we alluded to. Long story, listeners. Ravid has love interests. He finds the love of his life. Her former boyfriend doesn't like Ravid getting married to her. Duct tapes him, beats him up, takes him out deep into the waters, throws him overboard. And Ravid has to get back to shore using his wits. Ravid keeps coming back to that scene throughout the novel, and there were moments of sheer terror for him there, especially of the sharks. Could you talk about that scene and how it might differ from the scene with the moray eel?
Yeah, it was the same principle at play there. If you're in the ocean at night, especially on the surface, and that scene did occur on the surface, mm-hmm. and I have to tell you, I'm ashamed to say, on behalf of the land of Aloha, that whole segment was based on real time. That did occur. And so the obvious fear being in the ocean, especially out a couple miles at night, is sharks. And the lesson here was that, you know, some of the most aggressive sharks around here are tigers. We also have oceanic white tips. But they get so much bad press.
Mm-hmm.
And the overall lesson that I hope is here, the message, is that sharks are not the terror of the deep. It's the terror within that comes out when you're in the deep. You know, Peter Benchley was culpable, and he spent most of his last years apologizing and expressing contrition for what he had done, for showing the fear embodied in a shark, and the fear doesn't come from the shark. The shark is a very efficient animal part of nature, and we know this now with so many places banning shark finning. Hawaii led the charge on that, and I'm proud of that. But the other thing, I guess more lyrically speaking, is that Ravid feared the shark until he accepted the shark as a spirit guide. And that goes to, you know, a Hawaiian tradition and belief of aumakua, which means spirit guide. And it follows the same principle as, say, modern psychology, where you have the ego, the id, the ego, and the superego. In Christianity, you have the Trinity, and you have an aumakua. There's a consciousness, the subconsciousness, and the superconsciousness, and the animal spirit is on the level of superconsciousness. And people who think that shark is their aumakua are supposed to know, and I think the book attempts to explain this, supposed to know that the shark is the brother, the father, you know, the shark is ohana, the shark is family. And it's an act of faith. I personally think that my aumakua is shark because I've had personal experiences with sharks. And every time at the outset, especially if I'm in the water, I have that same jolt of fear. And in my mind, I try to tell my heart, set it aside, you know, set it aside. And the sharks do read that. This is not rational exchange we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it's irrational. It's just, you know, it's super conscious. Sharks do sense fear. They have lateral lines like all fish do. And they're acutely sensitive to electrons. And fear puts out a different electron than composure does. So you practice it. Sometimes it feels like you're not getting it right, but then you do get it right. If the shark doesn't eat, you got it right. It's those kinds of encounters are really gratifying. If you don't die.
Yeah. And then maybe not so much. I'm curious about Ravid. Initially lives in Maui, and his descriptions of what happens in Maui are pretty scathing. And as later in the novel, he rises to a sort of stardom and becomes an activist and begins to alert the public to the things that he recognized happening in Maui. Are these things that you aspire to do that kind of representation so that you spread the word? And is this the way to do it? Is this how to solve the problems of the tropical fish?
I'm not sure what the solution is. I can tell you that, I work on the anti-aquarium campaign probably 80% of my time. And I spend a lot of money on it.
Mm-hmm.
The aquarium trade accuses me of spending money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I freely concede, this is what I do. This is where I live. I don't know what the solution is. I can tell you that we're working on it. We had a bunch of campaigns in the legislature to pass legislation. Anybody familiar with that process, and I'm much more familiar with it now that I've been through it a few times, knows that a single senator can kill anything. It's next to impossible to pass anything unless it has really effective facilitation through the process. We had pretty good facilitation, but there were other vested interests that killed our efforts. We felt that every year, and the trade likes to phrase this in terms of our repetitive failed experience. Mm-hmm. I look at it as a huge success every year. It's just a tremendous time and money, and every year we open the eyes of thousands upon thousands more people to what's going on. It does happen underwater, which tends to be under the radar. And when you tell informed, intelligent, articulate people what's happening, that these guys can go out and empty any given reef, and it's legal, they just drop their guns and say, that can't be right. And it is, it's not right, but it's what's happening. And so we tried the legislative, then we met with, this is, you know, an equal opportunity issue as far as bipartisanship. We had the previous governor was a Republican who had a chief policy advisor who'd been a wholesale distributor for the aquarium trade. So where were her priorities? The current governor is a Democrat, just as bad, maybe worse. He appointed an aquarium collector to be director of natural resources. What's wrong with that picture?
Mm-hmm.
And now they're orchestrating, it's in the news, in fact, as we speak, trying to push these an administrative rules package where they have a whitelist. That's really going to solve things. They're going to agree that the aquarium collectors can't take every fish. They can only take 40 species. But if you look at the 40 species, they all got together on their little secret powwow and cooked up this list, applied to last the 2011 take, it would make a difference of less than 1%.
Hmm.
What's wrong with that picture? Okay, so we've been through, and we met with the governor. That was totally a stonewall experience. It was time-wasting, time-killing. He's not an honest fellow. He ran, actually, with quite a bit of conservation support. He's broken a ton of promises. And so we will try very hard to make him a one-termer. That would be Neil Abercrombie.
Mm-hmm.
So we've exhausted the we've been through the legislature. We've been through the executive. Last week or 2 weeks ago, the nonprofit law firm Earth Justice,
the
state of Hawaii, for failure to assess environmental impact before handing out the permits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are, and I try to get as much exposure as I can for it.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Robert Wintner, also known a.k.a. Snorkel Bob. He's just published, in addition to Flame Angels, a gorgeous full-color book of his own photography with Skyhorse Publishing, and it also comes with a DVD. The book is called Neptune's speaks. Just in following up that question, are you recommending that all aquarium collection be ended? Does that include professional aquariums like, you know, Monterey or...
I think aquarium collecting should be banned around the world.
Okay.
Full stop.
Full stop.
And, you know, the commercial aquariums were not on our hit list at the outset.
Right.
But they have come into this fray because they must have local people in remote places to do their dirty work. And so they're defending the trade lock, stock, and barrel.
Okay.
And their appetites are voracious. They fish die by the thousands in commercial aquariums every day. There's flat-screen TVs. There's reef cams with continuous loops. If you want to see the action, that's where to go. This is a dire world we're living in, and these things are not good. They're bad.
Right, right. And the ban is in effect now, or we talked about this when you were on the show in the past, that Maui County banned the collection of reef fish.
No, it gets a little bit complicated.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right, tell us.
Well, county jurisdiction ends at the high water line.
I see.
So they couldn't ban the collection, but they could regulate the business aspects to make it impractical.
Okay.
And it was very effective. And Maui County tends to be the lead island in the Hawaiian word pono. It means do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And Maui does the right thing. I'm pleased as I can be. I'm proud. And I try not to be proud of too much.
Right. And are you involved with things and other, is the Snorkel Bob Foundation involved in other parts of the world in this kind of activity as well? Or do you focus on Hawaii? Or
We tend to focus on Hawaii, but we are involved around the world. In fact, I'll tell you right here, and I haven't told this to anybody. I got an invitation, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to accept to be on the board of directors of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
Fabulous, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
right.
This connects the dots from the biggest animals in the ocean to the tiniest.
Right.
It's time to defend this stuff. And I was honored and flattered. And I think it's
absolutely
a good thing for all parties, and so that will take us internationally. And the aquarium trade likes to, since whale wars, everybody has seen that, trade likes to reference Sea Shepherd as supporting, you know, the aquarium trade calls itself conservation-oriented. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like if I shoot you in the head and say, well, that was for her own good. Mm-hmm. That would be silly. And they are silly. And so this, I think, Sea Shepherd's going to take an official position on this.
So has Sea Shepherd been involved in the aquarium business in the past, or is this a new direction for them?
They've been involved indirectly as far as supporting me. I've been on the board of advisors with Sea Shepherd for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've supported me, given me space on their website. If you go to seashepherd.org, you'll see both of these books for sale. I donated a bunch of books to Sea Shepherd.
Nice.
And so that money would go to them. And then they have a comment page on their website, seashepherd.org, where I put a status update on the aquarium trade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just gotten a world of exposure. Sea Shepherd's now a global movement.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I can see something like the whale wars with you kind of leading the charge against the aquarium collectors, you know, going out in your equipment and going head-to-head with the aquarium collectors.
It's happened.
Yeah.
I'll give you one example.
Okay.
This guy who's the, I'm not going to say his name on there. They love it when I say their names, and I won't do it because these are low-brow, low-rent people. And so one of these guys was at a hearing last year, and he said, Snorkel Bob is an eco-terrorist.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. That's good.
And I said, well, you know, I've written some incendiary emails, but I don't know about eco-terrorists.
Right.
There's one last working fishing village in Hawaii, Mililii in South Kona.
Okay.
And one of the guys there, in fact, he's a plaintiff on the Earth Justice litigation against the state. His name is Willie Kaupiko, mm-hmm. the fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
He caught this same guy poaching on a protected reef. And the guy came up blubbering, oh, no harm, no harm, honest mistake, sorry, and he left. 2 weeks later, Willie caught him again.
Oh, my gosh.
And Willie testified to the Board of Land and Natural Resources. The chair was this same aquarium collector who Neil Abercrombie appointed. So, you know, we are head-to-head. It's a contact sport here in Hawaii. And you know, it's too bad. And I think that it will be banned. I hope it's banned in my lifetime, and I think there's an excellent prospect.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about Neptune Speaks and then come back to the political issues. Neptune Speaks, a gorgeous book, hundreds and hundreds of photographs. And here we think of you and Ravid Rakhuls. First, tell us a little about your development as a photographer. How did you learn to get these incredible photographs?
I don't know if you can make a conscientious effort to learn anything. I wasn't any good at all, but I didn't know that. And I remember digital changed everything. If you see a marine photography book that was put together back in the days of film, that is an impressive feat. And those guys were going under, you know, back then rolls of film came 36 exposures, but the pros could roll their own and pack maybe 50 in there. Even so, 50 exposures on a dive is not many. I started off, you know, with a little, one of the first Canon point-and-shoots. You had to turn the thing on before you put it in the plastic case. And I got these cloudy, fuzzy, kind of focus photos of sea turtles, and I was just floored. I was just amazed and said, look what I did. And stayed with that for a little while. In about a year, I moved up to, you know, a digital SLR with a bigger housing, but it was still low-end. shrinking camera syndrome set in, and now I've thrown, I don't know, about my new rig is probably about $13,000 or $14,000.
Oh, wow.
I got the 36-megapixel Nikon D800 and the strobes and the housing and, you know, all that, and I just love it. And, of course, you know, if you love something, you're probably going to be blind to your limitations and your shortfalls. You just keep doing it because it's so much fun.
Yeah, your passion. Yeah.
And it will gradually get better. You won't notice it getting better. I didn't notice it getting better. And my friends said, you know, well, you know, these are getting much better. And I think that they were. We got a trip coming up in January. The next book, the working title is Reef Libre. Leave it to the communists to trash their economic system so much they have the most perfect reefs in the world. We're going to Cuba.
Ah.
It's the only reef system on planet E that is rated 100% pristine intact.
My gosh.
Yeah, and so we're going to document that. Really looking forward to it, really excited about it. And it's going to be a great trip, and I'm trying to feel... You know, my only concern is personal energy level.
Yeah.
It's like, I think we're going to do just a bunch of dives over about a three-week period, and should be a great adventure.
So I'd be curious to know just a little bit more about what a dive is like and what you can predict about what you'll find and how much you plan before you go down about what you want to. Can you plan at all, or do you just go and see what's there?
Well, the fundamental adage of scuba diving is plan your dive and dive your plan. We tend to get a little casual. We dive once or twice a week here, and we know these areas.
Right.
You can go to a certain area because you know that an exotic might be there. I know where a couple flame angels live. I know where a dragon moray lives. But you can't really tell what you're going to run into on any given day. What you hope for more than anything is what I call photo-perfect blue. That means the suspended particles in the water are minimal or not there. They're absent completely. One good thing, and I really want to tell this little anecdote, you know, the aquarium trade, something like more than two-thirds of their catch, it's millions of fish a year, are herbivores, mostly yellow tangs. It's a brilliant yellow fish. And they have the little white things between the body and the tail. They're razor sharp. That's why they're called surgeon fish. And they use them defensively. They'll flick the tail to what we call these days an inappropriate approach from the rear. And you can't get near a yellow tang, can't get too near. And when you do, you can't get them to turn around. We went over to the island of Lanai, which is right across from Maui, down about 50, 55 feet. Lanai is pretty well known, pretty popular for blue water. And I just did a glance to my left, and there was about a 10-inch brood tang who swam up, and faced me.
My
and that's
gosh.
The cover of Neptune Speaks.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah.
And I just turned and held my breath, because sometimes bubbles spook them, and pushed the button. And I looked down at my liquid crystal display, and I just said, thank you.
Yeah.
It just feels like a gift. And, you know, you asked about how do you develop. I think you learn what not to do. You do less and less. You don't chase the fish.
Right.
The money shot is from a few degrees below with both eyes and the mouth talking at you.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said, didn't you, the Ravid developed a technique of waiting until just the instant when the fish was turning, and that was a key point of his photographs. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, and when you get down there, especially, you know, I've been several times to the Coral Triangle, and it's famous for diversity and abundance, and that is all a function of currents. And when you're in a current, you really have far less control than in still water. Still water is a gas if it's blue and fishy. If you're in a current, you got to just take what you can get, mm-hmm. and you're twisting around and trying to get the right angle, and you take what you can get, and, you know, sometimes you get lucky. You know, the turn and the flourish, those are perfect shots. It's not like a regular studio situation where you can set and try and change. You go, boom, that's the time that you have to get your shot. Right. You get it or you don't. You wouldn't believe the shots I haven't got.
Yeah.
They're not in the book.
Right. Why did you write Neptune Speaks? And who is Neptune, and what is he speaking about?
You know, the book we talked about a couple years ago was Some Fishes I Have Known,
mm-hmm.
which more or less introduced the idea of social engagement with cold-blooded gill breathers. And a lot of people think that's a little nutty and screwy. In only 2 years' time, that idea has gained acceptance.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. If you know people who live near reefs and they visit those reefs regularly, most of those people can tell you of their regular fish that they visit. And the fish do get more familiar.
Hmm.
The next book, which was last year, was Every Fish Tells a Story. And that delved a little deeper into fish personalities. Neptune Speaks, as you could tell, it had two narratives, mm-hmm. and then photo captions. The first narrative is my voice, and the second narrative is the voice I give to these fish.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was Neptune speaking, just like the yellow tang who came up and said, thank you. He said it first. I take it as gratitude. I got to tell you, that you have different encounters that just keep you going. There's a subject I can't talk about, and that's my dog, who I lost a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry.
Extremely difficult.
Yes.
And I was over at this same place on Lanai, and a school of raccoon butterfly fish kind of came over. Maybe they were curious. I don't know what. And I raised my camera to take a picture, and the lead raccoon butterfly swam over my camera between the camera and my chest.
Oh, my gosh.
Very strange. And I held still because I didn't want to hurt him.
Right.
And as I held still, the other fish came in, about 30 of them. They all touched me.
Hmm.
My gosh.
That's the sort of thing that keeps me going.
Yeah. Magical.
And it feels like Neptune's message.
Yes.
Right.
It feels like Neptune's gratitude.
Yeah.
And so who is Neptune? Well, who do you want Neptune to be? That's who Neptune is.
Also in the book, Neptune has no patience with the idea of sustainability or reef management. That is, Neptune is uncompromising. He says, leave the fish alone. This is not something where you do so-called sustainable harvest or manage the crop.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you what the definition, sustainable is one of those words. As soon as you see it, look out. The definition of sustainable is it's an acceptable level of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we can trash, and we won't kill it, maybe.
We want to jump back in a moment to your political work. Let's just clarify for our audience the two books. We're talking with Robert Wintner. The novel is Flame Angels. It's published by Iguana Books, and you can track that down on the web, Robert Wintner, WINTNER, dot iguanabooks.com, and it's available in electronic version as well as print. Neptune Speaks is published by Skyhorse Publishing, and you can learn more about that at www.skyhorsepublishing.com. And we'll put both of those links up on our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. But perhaps we could just jump back. Where are you going with the political action now? You caught us up on the last 2 weeks. What are your plans for the near and distant future?
We're probably going to be looking at the state of we're going to be focusing on the state of Hawaii legislatively, at the executive level, trying to make some changes there, and judicially. And beyond that, you know, we just had an election, and so we may come down to the low-hanging fruit as well. Not that it's going to be easy picking, but I just hope that there's some aquarium trade collectors listening. And I would really sincerely advise, start thinking about a new line of work, because this ain't going away. Mm-hmm. It is not going away. That's the deal. And I would also like to add, you know, in addition to, you say, Iguana Books and Skyhorse Press, both of these books are available at snorkelbob.com, and there's a free shipping option.
Great.
And all the dollars from those sales will accrue to this campaign.
Great.
To end the aquarium trade.
And how else can our listeners become involved with and support your work? Are there other things that they can learn and do at www.snorkelbob.com?
Yeah, there's on the homepage, there's a link to the Neptune Speaks book page. And on the Neptune Speaks book page, you'll find a link to the Aquarium Campaign site where you can follow progress and participate in the campaign. I'll also throw out another website and organization called Reef, and this is the web address as well. It's three words, but it's all run together for the web address. It's reefrescuealliance.org.
Reefrescuealliance.org.
And we'll that's a group of individuals, groups, and just interested parties who are just outraged that Hawaii reefs are getting plucked clean.
Right.
I mean, how anybody listening, let me just ask you a question. How would you feel if these guys came down your street with nets and started netting all the songbirds?
Right, right. Yeah. We've been talking with Robert Wintner, a.k.a. Snorkel Bob, about his two books, Neptune Speaks and Flame
Angels.
I just went out of my head. And you can make contact with him and what he's doing at www.snorkelbob.com. Also, for our KZFR listeners, Snorkel Bob has provided us with review copies of these two lovely books. And if you can tell us that you participated in our recent pledge drive, or if you're willing to make a contribution to KZFR Community Radio, the books are yours as a premium. You can email us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. These are absolutely, Neptune Speaks is an absolutely gorgeous book. And as you heard from Snorkel Bob's reading, there's a lot of excitement in Flame Angels.
There is, although I have to say, Snorkel Bob, after reading about the moray eel, I'm not so certain that I'm ever going to do my first dive. But other than that, we want to thank you, Robert Wintner, Snorkel Bob, for being with us tonight. We really admire your energy, your commitment, and we very much look forward to your next books, DVDs, photographs, or whatever comes from your imaginative mind. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and I also want to thank you. You guys are the type of people and media people who do make a difference, and I just want to thank you for giving a damn. It does make a difference, and it is adding up.
Wow, thank you. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Ahoy ho.
Good night.